From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. While President Biden was meeting with leaders of the G7 in England today, the pressures of domestic politics were rising here in the U.S. A deal on infrastructure is on the horizon, but it is not clear that the president or even Democrats are going to sign on to it.
And Democratic outrage is growing on news that the Trump Justice Department subpoenaed Apple for the phone data of lawmakers connected to the Russia investigation. Let's start there with Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And Maya King, national politics reporter for Politico. Hi, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So on MSNBC last night, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff called for an investigation after it became known that Trump's attorney general had secretly seized his and his committee's phone data in an attempt to find the source of leaks in the investigation of Trump's connections to Russia. Here is Congressman Adam Schiff.
It's extraordinary, maybe unprecedented, for the department to seek records like this of a member of Congress or staff of a member of Congress, to do so in a partisan way, to do so when they're investigating him, to do so openly calling on his department. It's hard to express just how shocking an abuse of power this really is.
Rick, put this story into context for us. Is it unprecedented? I mean, both the Trump and Obama administrations pursued journalists who they saw as leakers. So what's notable here and what effect does it have?
What's different here is we're talking about duly elected members of Congress, a whole different.
Did we just lose Rick?
Rick?
With members of Congress is when they're personally being investigated for corruption. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, please continue.
Should we go on to Maya?
Yeah, let's see if Rick can get
his connection in place. Maya, let's pick this up with you. Politico is reporting that the former president, Donald Trump, he felt vindicated this week after an inspector general concluded that Trump did not clear Lafayette Square in front of the White House last June to take a photo in front of a burnt-out church, if you remember that. And this morning, you know, we didn't hear Republicans rush to condemn the Trump Justice Department for subpoenaing those lawmaker records. How are you reading into this?
Well, I think this is part of a broader pattern with the former president of sort of weaponizing the agencies and other items just kind of under his purview against his perceived enemies. I think that's exactly what we saw with the Department of Justice and especially not just with Democrats, but also with reporters and members of the media. I imagine he certainly, you know, there were reports after last summer all about how what happened at Lafayette Square was very much, you know, a part of his own plan. And yet now he's certainly feeling vindicated because we've discovered that it really wasn't. And so I think, you know, this is just, again, a broader pattern of sort of how the former president has really shifted things in Washington to make, I think, a lot of us a lot more skeptical of what these ulterior motives are. But we'll still be able to it remains to be seen exactly what the outcome of this next investigation will be for his relationship with DOJ as it relates to Democrats and members of the media.
And I will note that we are still talking about the former president, even though he is the former president. So that is useful to him in that way. A group of 10 moderate Senate Republicans and Democrats have come up with a compromise deal to pay for infrastructure improvements in this country. I spoke with one of them, Montana Democrat John Tester, about it this morning. He said it's not going to be easy to pass in the Senate.
I think it's going to take more than just 10 Republicans. I think the Republicans will tell you that, because quite honestly, there's no guarantee we're going to keep all the Democrats.
And one of the reasons, Maya, they may not keep all the Democrats is because Tester told me this is a traditional infrastructure bill. There's a lot that's not in there. What else are we learning today?
Well, I think we're starting to really see these splits along ideological lines. I think the senator is right to say this is a much more traditional bill. And what progressives in Congress have been saying for a while is that the moment that we find ourselves in requires a much bigger and much more expensive infrastructure bill, that the U.S. government is going to need to be willing to spend more. And it seems like it just according to the readouts from these conversations between moderate Democrats and Republicans, particularly in the Senate, that's kind of the hang-up here, is just how much money the government is willing to spend on this and what they're willing to spend it on and where they're willing to get that money from, whether it's COVID relief or taxes on the wealthy. And so, I mean, if they do emerge with a more traditional infrastructure bill, I think what we can expect to see, quite frankly, are a number of progressives threatening not to vote for it. In fact, we've already seen that. Some progressives in Congress have already said, you know, don't really count on our vote here if you're not willing to stretch yourself to actually pay for the things that we're asking for. So, you know, I think us in Washington are used to it being infrastructure week for weeks and weeks on end, and I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon, especially as conversations just continue to unfold around exactly what will fall under the purview of this bill, which just still seems to be rather unclear.
But Rick, at some point, President Biden is going to have to make a decision here, right, on whether to accept a smaller deal with Republicans or use budget maneuvers to pass his more expansive infrastructure plans with just Democratic votes. I mean,
that's exactly right.
Are we getting to that point?
Very close to it. I mean, look, Biden has tried to keep both paths open. He's tried to say, look, we've got bipartisanship over here. We have a partisan path over there. One complicating factor is, though, it's not clear that he could even get all the Democrats on board for some of these proposals. So he may not have that backup option. But I think now that we're past at least two deadlines that the White House has set, we're fast getting into the place where Joe Biden's going to have to come down and say, this is what a package looks like. And keep in mind, this bipartisan deal right now, it's got elements in it that Biden himself has rejected, including the idea of raising the gas tax and indexing it to inflation. He considers that a tax on people making less than $400,000 a year. So it's not clear that even for all these talks that it's going to go anywhere. And I think this next couple of weeks, probably before the 4th of July, we'll know up or down infrastructure either happening or not.
And what's not getting done in Washington, Maya, as the White House seeks this bipartisan infrastructure deal?
Well, a number of his Biden's top legislative priorities domestically have kind of hit snags here. I mean, I think we can point to voting rights legislation. That was one of his biggest targets, I think, of this year to try to get done. And with comments from Senators Manchin and Sinema coming out against the filibuster, that kind of renders that legislation, dead in the water, unfortunately. I think also conversations around policing have hit pretty rough snag over the last couple of days. We have some reporting out to suggest that the notion of, or the provision, I should say, of qualified immunity is still a sticking point in these negotiations between legislators. And now we've got a lot more involvement from law enforcement groups that have also said, you know, from their knowledge of the current state of negotiations, they would not support this bill either. So the president, the Biden administration, has come forward, of course, with its first 100 days with a very, very bold legislative plan to try to push through legislation, particularly as it relates to equity and racial equity. And yet, as it stands right now, not saying that they absolutely are impossible, but I think it's what we're learning now is that it's just going to be much more of a process if it happens at all. And it's just going to take a lot longer and require a lot more going back to the table and sitting down and potentially watering down a lot of this legislation.
And so, Rick, where do you see Biden's agenda right now with these snags, as Maya talked about?
Well, I really think this is a pivotal moment for the Biden presidency, even as he continues this foreign trip, because you're at a potential inflection point where he's going to have to decide, do I pursue bipartisanship? Do I take smaller deals, or do I continue to try to pursue bigger transformational goals? When you see the jitters around the economy, when you see Democrats turning on themselves a little bit, you get a sense of some of the angst around this. And I think Biden has taken as much of a hands-off approach as he could to this legislative process, certainly a lot less heavy-handed than his predecessor in terms of dictating what happens. But he's going to have to come down. And I think he has this majority. It's an extremely narrow majority. He knows where the red lines are. The contours haven't really changed of those limitations. It's become clear, though, that there's growing frustration in the left of his party, among moderates. And this is a time for leadership, at the time where he's going to have to decide, this is what I can take, and this is what I think the best course is.
Rick, you mentioned the president's trip to Europe. How do you think that is shaping up so far? Beyond theater, do you think his first foreign trip will have much of an impact?
Well, I think coming with a deliverable, actually delivering 500 million doses of COVID vaccine is a powerful signal. And of course, it's substantively important as well as symbolically that the America First is out, and instead you've got America, as he says, America's back, trying to show that there's open hands of cooperation. I think the G7 meetings are likely to be a little more tense than the meeting with the Prime Minister of Great Britain. We saw Boris Johnson there, just enthusiastic about this new relationship and the opportunities for cooperation. And then I think everything's going to be defined with the Vladimir Putin meeting toward the end of this trip. So there's so much riding on that. But it's a big moment for him to set the agenda as opposed to just react to events.
Maya, we have less than a minute here. Why don't you give us your thoughts on this meeting with Putin and what the president needs to accomplish?
Well, I think really it'll be reestablishing a bit more of a firm hand between Russia and the United States. Of course, there's a precedent now with the former president, who, of course, is looming over things still in Washington, of a more friendly relationship here. But the president has been very clear that he not only wants to establish more leadership there, but also in noting the issues that America and Russia have faced in the past.
Maya King, national politics reporter for Politico, and Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The FDA has extended the expiration date on the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine by 6 weeks. That could save hundreds of thousands of doses from going to waste. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said recently that 200,000 J&J doses would expire later this month. Other states are issuing similar warnings, and with the number of vaccines administered going down, healthcare providers are looking for ways to get those doses used. David John is CEO of Chippewa County War Memorial Hospital in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. David, welcome.
Welcome.
And with this vaccine rate falling, a lot of healthcare providers, as I said, starting to worry about doses going to waste. What do you think about the FDA there extending the shelf life for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine by 6 weeks?
That definitely helps the situation. It allows us more time to provide that vaccine to people who might want it. You know, we have the other brands as well, Pfizer and Moderna. You know, I don't know if they'll be extended or not, but any extra time we have to provide the vaccine to individuals is greatly appreciated.
How much urgency do you feel to get your doses into arms so that they don't go to waste?
Well, currently we have about 1,500 doses of the Pfizer vaccine that will expire at the end of July. And with our vaccination rates pretty low right now, maybe doing 20 a week, something like that, you know, we're probably going to have over 1,000 vaccines that might expire at the end of July. So that's very concerning to us.
1,000, you know, in the big picture, not that much, but you're a small community, right?
Correct. And, you know, we probably have received 5,000 doses at the beginning. So 1,000 doses is, you know, is a large percentage if you have to waste it.
Do you think at this point you've pretty much vaccinated everyone in your community that wants one?
At this point, yes. You know, there's about 46% of our community that is vaccinated, but every day, you know, we offer the vaccine, and that we just aren't getting any takers at this point for whatever reason it might be. Hmm.
So with the potentially wasted doses on the horizon here that you're staring down, I understand that you're trying to figure out what you might be able to do with them. And one of the solutions could be sharing with Canadians. You're very close to the border there. Tell me about that.
Yes, we're a mile from Canada. I can see Canada out my window. We have a number.
Thank you, Sarah Palin.
Yeah, we have a number of Canadian employees who come over every day to work here. And their family members are not able to get the vaccine yet, some of them over in Canada. At the same time, Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario has a larger hospital than us. And, you know, their rollout was to give one dose of the vaccine to everybody first before people get second doses. And we've thought about, with the extra vaccine, offering it to the healthcare workers in Canada so that they have the second dose and have the higher level of protection.
Hmm. So that sounds very generous of you, but is it even possible to move doses across borders like that?
Well, at first, the obstacle was the Ontario Ministry and the Algoma Health that would put pretty stringent quarantine restrictions on anybody who would try to come over and get the vaccine from us. They've kind of loosened those rules a little bit now, but now it's right on the U.S. side of the border where the U.S. side is saying coming to get a vaccine is not essential travel. The border is closed to only essential travel, and so they're not allowing Canadian citizens to come over to get the vaccine.
So do you think this could end up being a solution to your potential waste here, or are you encountering too many problems?
Oh, it's definitely a solution. You know, we're hearing that there's discussion in Canada about opening the border. We hope that it opens soon, but even if it didn't open completely soon, it would be nice if the U.S. and Canadian officials could get together and say in these border communities, essential travel does include getting a vaccine. If they just made that change alone, that would really help. And, we could get our friends and neighbors, across the river vaccinated and create a safer community for everybody.
It is very neighborly of you to share your doses, but some people might ask, why? Why not send those elsewhere in the United States?
From what I've heard, there aren't any other areas in the United States that need the vaccine. I know in Michigan, most every hospital, health department, local pharmacy has enough vaccine for the demand that's happening right now. Certainly, if we knew there was an area in the United States that was short on vaccine and needed vaccine, we would definitely do that. But at this point, we are unaware of any place in the U.S. that needs extra vaccine. So that's the reason we looked across to Canada.
Really paints a picture of how different the vaccine situation is from country to country, even just over the border there in Canada. David John, CEO and president of Chippewa County War Memorial Hospital in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
June is Pride Month, and social media companies are offering space to LGBTQ communities by changing tools and language to make their platforms more welcoming. Pinterest is among them. It released an ad a few days ago featuring users from around the world sharing their stories of identity and self-expression.
This is just who I am.
The internet was my safe space.
My whole life is so queer now.
Parce que tu vas vivre une vie merveilleuse.
There being no one right way to be queer.
But social media efforts like these sometimes come under criticism for being performative without meaningful action to actually support queer people. Let's bring in Femi Ok, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She helps us dissect social media trends. Femi, welcome.
Hello there, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So what are some of the Pride initiatives that you're seeing from some of these social media companies?
Almost all of the big platforms, the social media platforms, have some kind of Pride campaign. I've picked out a few that really leapt out at me. Facebook, for instance, is creating space on one of its digital platforms for coming out conversations. Now, these could be intense. So Facebook is partnering up with organizations with expertise in this area. Over on Instagram is focusing on promoting young voices and creatives like Flawless Kevin. In a June post, Flawless Kevin transforms Target's Pride collection. Now, we could do a whole segment, Peter, on Target's Pride collection. Let's just say it's received mixed reviews, but Flawless Kevin makes the collection look amazing. Finally, I want to highlight TikTok. They're looking forward to their Pride March on June the 24th, 12 hours long, over multiple countries. It should be pretty spectacular. And all this month, TikTok is also featuring LGBTQ digital trailblazers. Have a listen.
This Pride Month and for your Pride, TikTok is pledging to celebrate diverse voices,
commit to change through education,
and create a place where everyone is free to be.
Free to be.
Free to be.
To be.
So, Femi, does this kind of thing on TikTok feel, more like a marketing opportunity or actual allyship?
So there are clues, but you have to look beyond the rainbow packaging. So let me give you an example. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal has a non-gender conforming child. So she knows what being a genuine ally looks like. And the Congresswoman has been tweeting about companies who have changed their logos into pride colours for June, but also support and donate to lawmakers who oppose the Equality Act. So she's pointing out these mixed messages. So far, Walmart, American Airlines, JP Chase and Morgan have all been mentioned. Many more companies have been called out for their hypocrisy. You can see some of them on her Twitter feed at Representative at Rep Jayapal. But using these pride colours for marketing purposes is known as rainbow washing. I want you to have a listen to Blair Imani. She's a bisexual black author and educator, and she breaks down this practice for her followers. Here she is.
Rainbow washing, also known as pink washing, is when a company or other institution lies about their support of the LGBTQ plus community to sell products. And of course, not all marketing during Pride is rainbow washing, but it happens a lot. Ask yourself these questions to avoid being fooled. Are they using the rainbow to hide other oppressive actions? Are they only vocal about LGBTQ plus people and our rights during Pride? Do they hire us? And what about in leadership? Do they support us with their resources, policies, and actions? If you really want to support us, you can't just do it in June and you can't just add a rainbow.
I see. So that is rainbow washing. What can people do if they want to truly show up for the community?
Have a look out. There are a couple of great accounts, great organizations that you will guide you. That you can even type into GLAAD, how do I be a good ally? And GLAAD will help you out. Also the Trevor Project as well. Many more organizations, but they're out there and they are willing to talk to allies. And also, of course, the LGBTQ plus community. Something that stuck in my mind when I was looking at rainbow washing came from Mikey Robinson. And he says his pronouns are he, him, and hun. And he posted this recently. Pride wasn't brought to you by T-Mobile or Absolute Vodka. It was brought to you by drag queens, trans women throwing bricks, by lesbians and queer women taking care of gay men dying of AIDS. So the true meaning of pride is out there. You just have to look over the rainbows.
Indeed. Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
On NPR's Rough Translation, a civilian and a soldier looking for love.
I tried to use some of my best lines on Alicia. I told her I'd die for her.
She said, I'll die for you. I was like, you're a soldier. You'll die for anyone.
Stories about connection and missed connections. Each week on Homefront, the new season from Rough Translation.
A cherished New York institution reopened yesterday, the Drama Bookshop. A mecca for both theater lovers and professionals, the store had closed before the pandemic, but is now getting a second act. Jeff London reports.
When I was a theater-obsessed teenager, there were two places I went to when I visited New York. The TKTS booth, where I'd buy half-price tickets to Broadway shows, and the Drama Bookshop. In those days, you rode a creaky elevator up to a cramped space filled with scripts and scores and biographies and histories and theater magazines. It was heaven. On reopening day, the Drama Bookshop's manager, Alan Hubby, he's been there almost as long as I've been a customer, told me it's been very emotional.
People will call me up in tears. You're really reopening it, like, they're so excited. And getting here this morning, we got here about a half hour before the store opened, and there's already a line down the block, people waiting to get in. It's amazing.
I chatted with theater lovers, writers, and actors like Cassandra Guglielmo, who was sitting on a sofa with a pile of books, leafing through one about acting Shakespeare.
When I was going to school studying acting, I would come almost every day and just read as many plays as I could until the store closed or until I had to head to class or to work or something. I came today because today was opening day and wasn't really something I wanted to miss.
Over the years, the Drama Bookshop has been a home for many theater makers like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Thomas Kail, creators of the Broadway hits Hamilton and In the Heights. 19 years ago, when they were aspiring artists, Alan Hubby invited them to use space in the basement and said to Kail,
"Hey, see this little white room downstairs? I'd like to make it into a black box, and we'd like you to be the resident theater company." And we said, "Do you have any black paint?" And he said, "Yeah, that's how you make it a black box. We developed In the Heights down there."
By 2019, with growing competition and a hefty rent hike, the shop closed its doors.
"You'll be back soon, you'll see."
But flush with royalties and gratitude, Kail and Miranda plotted a rescue. They bought the Drama Bookshop, found a new location, and hired David Korins, Hamilton's set designer, to create the interior. Inspired by 19th century cafes, people can sit, read, and drink coffee all over the shop, including on two replicas of the chairs George Washington sits on during the cabinet battles in Hamilton, says Korins.
"So for the total theater geeks like I am, you want to come and sit in George Washington's chair. It's not that it's like a tourist trap moment. It's actually a connectivity to the theater community."
"Ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere in the world tonight, but you're here with us in New York City. Are you ready for a cabinet meeting, huh?"
Most dramatically, David Korins has designed a sculpture that spirals in and around the shop over the stacks, and it's made entirely of books.
"The bookworm, as we call it, breaks through our back wall and is a 3,500-pound, 140-foot-long, 2,500-book timeline of almost 2,500 years of theater history from the ancient Greeks all the way down to when we stopped construction on this project."
Judging from the opening crowd, the Drama Bookshop, which has been around in one form or another since 1917, is a hit. Co-owner Thomas Kail:
"I think that with theater starting to come back in New York City and around the country and around the world, this feels like it's part of that movement. You know, my joke is it's us and Bruce Springsteen that are opening in New York first."
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
There's been a lot of pregame commentary about President Biden's upcoming meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but Biden has another one-on-one that might be just as important. On Monday, on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Biden will sit down with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center. He's on Skype. Michael, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Good to be here with you.
So the tensions with Russia, they're obvious. Election interference, cyber attacks, aggression in Crimea. But what about these issues with Turkey? Even though it's supposed to be an ally, remind us some of the sore spots between Washington and Ankara.
Well, I think one of the major ones is a recent military deal that Turkey concluded with Russia, in which Turkey acquired some major defense technologies known as an S-400 deal. And this is something that the U.S. did not respond well to and, in fact, placed sanctions on Turkey. And it also essentially kicked Turkey out of this F-35 fighter jet program that Turkey had been involved with helping produce these craft. And this had helped Turkey economically and militarily. So that's really the big tension point. But, you know, the U.S. and Turkey have also had differing policies in the Middle East. And most recently, the Biden administration's recognition of the Armenian genocide, that really heightened tensions even more between these two NATO partners.
Why did Turkey buy a missile defense system from Russia anyway? I mean, they must have known it was going to irk Washington.
They likely knew that, but they may not have necessarily thought that the United States would react in the way it would in terms of sanctioning Turkey. May not have expected that the U.S. would be willing to do that with a NATO partner. And clearly that backfired given what happened.
You know, a good point, because I'm trying to think of another American NATO ally that is at odds with the U.S. like Turkey is. So, what's ahead for President Biden as he sits down with Erdogan next week? I mean, what is he going to try to accomplish?
Well, I think that one of the major objectives will be to work through these tensions that have emerged in recent years. I think that both sides at the end of the day want to make this relationship work. Now, really, for the U.S., the major concern is that if Turkey has possession of this Russian military technology, That could cause a lot of problems for U.S. military cooperation with Turkey, and it would raise concerns that Russia would be able to gain access to NATO information and all types of things. But you know, one of the interesting areas here is Afghanistan. Turkey recently offered to help secure the airport in Kabul after foreign forces have left. And there's some indication to believe that maybe that's meant to be some type of outreach to the United States to say, well, look, you know, we're offering to help secure this airport after everyone else has left. And in return, let's talk about what we could do on some other issues in our relationship to try to move past these tensions.
So a goodwill gesture of sorts. Do you think that the United States would be interested in that?
I think it would. You know, obviously the airport is essential. You've got a country, Afghanistan, it's likely to be destabilized much more after foreign forces have left. And that could make it very difficult for countries to be willing to maintain staff and embassies there. It would make it hard for aid workers to get into the country. But I think the bigger issue is the Taliban. The Taliban has actually already declared Turkey would not be welcome to do that. And that is because Turkey is a NATO partner. And the U.S. signed an agreement with the Taliban some time ago that essentially said that all foreign troops must be out of the country. So it could be hard to move forward on that front, even though I don't think that the U.S. would want to oppose that necessarily at all.
What do you think President Erdogan's ambitions are on the world stage?
I mean, he is clearly trying to deepen influence, power. I mean, this we're already talking about a regional power, and you know, he's someone that wants to expand that. But I think that this is also a leader that, like many strongmen out there these days, many of these authoritarian leaders, is looking to find ways to gain more global goodwill. And this is why the offer of securing the airport in Afghanistan could be useful. Not to mention Turkey's broader willingness to play a role in the peace process in Afghanistan. This is a leader that wants to find a way to make the relationship with the United States work, despite all these problems. You know, this is a really significant meeting that he's having with Biden. And the fact that they are going to meet face to face at a moment when tensions are so high, I think that in of itself is significant about how keen they are to try to find ways to get back on a better platform. But again, we're talking about a relationship that's facing tensions like it hasn't seen in many decades. So it's not going to be easy.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director at the Asia Program at the Wilson Center. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's remember one of the nearly 600,000 people who have died of COVID-19 in the United States. Wyvis Oxendine Sr. was a longtime educator and county commissioner from North Carolina who made a lasting impression on almost everyone he met. Laura Pellissier from member station WUNC has more.
Wyvis Oxendine Sr. had a tendency to stand out.
You would not forget Wyvis Sr. the first time you met him. I don't care if it was a little joke, a little story that he told. When he walked into the room, you knew that his presence was there.
His son, Wyvis Jr., and his wife, Denise Oxendine, flipped through photos in their family living room in the small town of Maxton, near the North Carolina-South Carolina border.
That's him right there with the trophy in his hand. That was the conference championship, right? And you see all the crowd around. He got MVP of the game.
Senior, as he was known to friends and family, had a fierce talent from a young age. He played basketball, volleyball, and was extended an offer to join the Minnesota Twins minor league baseball system, an offer that came a little too late since he'd already signed up to serve in the Air Force.
He wouldn't push it into you, say, you know, I used to could throw about 100, you know, triple digits and just remind you how talented, how gifted he was. And it's like, yeah, Dad, I know.
Whatever he took on, he was tenacious. That drive got him to Harvard grad school, where he became the second member of the Lumbee tribe and one of the first Native Americans to get a graduate degree from Harvard. Denise says it wasn't always easy.
One of his colleagues said, you'll never make it. You know, you're a Native American, you won't make it. And that gave him that extra incentive and that extra push to say, yes, I can, and I'm going to show not just me, but for the rest of my people and for the world that we can make it.
Wyvis did make it. He graduated from Harvard with a master's in education in 1977. Once home, he got to work, trying to improve opportunities for others. One of his big goals was to balance out educational opportunities in Robeson County, in the southern part of North Carolina. His friend, Jack Morgan, was also an educator, then a fellow Robeson County commissioner. He describes one of Wyvis's biggest accomplishments.
At one point, there were six school systems in Robeson County, and those school systems were all fighting each other.
The school systems were divided along racial lines and with big differences in resources. Morgan says Wyvis was pivotal in the push for merging the school systems. Wyvis also had other public jobs, including county commissioner and assistant principal. But his family and friends, like fellow educator Walter Jackson, say some of Wyvis's best work happened behind the scenes.
He served without wanting any type of notoriety for the things that he did.
Instead, as his wife Denise describes, it was in the small ways that he supported and lifted up people around him.
I've seen him get 20, 30 phone calls and from the afternoon until, you know, he got ready to retire, which might be 2 o'clock sometimes at night. One time it was a husband and wife having trouble. And somebody said, he'll help you. If you go to him, he'll help you.
Robeson County, where Wyvis and many Lumbee live, has been deeply affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. At least 1 in 8 residents in the county contracted COVID. This past winter, the virus swept through the Oxendine family. Senior had pre-existing health conditions, including diabetes, high blood pressure, and Alzheimer's. And it didn't take long for the disease to take hold. In January, Wyvis' family donned masks and gathered for a small graveside ceremony. But Wyvis Jr. says it wasn't a funeral. It was a going home celebration.
We know it was hard. We know it was heartbreaking. But we have the belief and the faith that when he said goodbye on this side, he opened his eyes on the other. And we call it going home because as hard as it was to get through, we believe he made it home and one day we'll go see him again.
For Here and Now, I'm Laura Pelliser.
If you could see inside instead.
This is Here and Now.
You would see a brand new man. Cause the old man.
If you're looking for a new scare, look no further than Lisi's Story on Apple TV Plus. It stars Julianne Moore as the widow of a famous author who has to deal with a supernatural realm he once inhabited. In other words, it's classic Stephen King, who also happened to write the screenplay. A new episode comes out today. And we're also marking another occasion, the end of an era. Keeping Up with the Kardashians aired its final episode last night. Lots to talk about with NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So, Lisi's Story has a really impressive pedigree. J.J. Abrams is one of the executive producers. It also features Clive Owen and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Stephen King, though, is as much a star as anyone, and he adapted this himself. Tell us about the premise of this program.
Yeah, well, you know, how much time do we have? It's a really interesting and twisty premise. But basically, Julianne Moore plays the wife of a famous novelist played by Clive Owen. And this novelist has died. And so part of the story is her grieving him and trying to get over his loss. She's being pressured by academics and other people to provide his unpublished works. And so we have this clip. Let's check it out.
You are not getting in there and you are never going to see his papers.
You were nothing but a restaurant hostess when you caught his eye. The fact that you slept in his bed does not give you the right to withhold his unwritten papers from the rest of the world.
Oh my God.
And then some words follow that we can't broadcast on radio. But basically, that gives you the level of pressure that she's under. So there's that whole story, which is very conventional. And then also, there's this sense that her husband had this ability to go inside this supernatural realm. And that's where the story gets really sort of bizarre and twisty and impressionistic, and it becomes a true sort of Stephen King story. And what's notable about this, of course, is that he wrote every script for every one of the episodes, so he was adapting his own very popular novel.
Well, that's right. I mean, Stephen King novels have been adapted dozens of times, but not usually by him. So what do you think, Eric? How did he do translating Lisi's story to the screen?
Well, the thing that's interesting to me about this is that even Stephen King struggles to adapt Stephen King novels to television. I think part of the challenge is that so much of the drama of a Stephen King novel comes from the way he puts you inside the head of the protagonist and the other characters. And I think it's very hard to create a TV show or a movie that also accomplishes that. And so, you know, for me, Lisi's story, I wasn't as moved by it as I hoped I would be. I wonder if it couldn't have benefited from somebody who had a little more distance from the work actually adapting it for television.
Well, let's turn to something for a moment a little less complicated, the final episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
You know, Kim has been struggling for a while privately behind camera about her relationship.
I think he deserves someone that can go support his every move and go follow him all over the place and move to Wyoming. I can't do that.
Well, love him or hate him, Eric, the Kardashians ushered in a world of influencers and social media stars. So I'm curious, what do you make of their show finally ending? And what does it say about the media landscape we're in right now?
It's like, oh my God, I just can't believe that like it's ending. No, I'm sorry. I watched too much of the show and I wind up talking like them. But what's interesting to me about this, and the show is actually moving. They're going to do versions of it for Hulu. So it's not exactly completely ending, but you're right. They pioneered this idea of sort of celebrities being out there and living these very sort of tumultuous and drama-filled lives and then monetizing that experience. And now it's reached a point where people are doing this as quote-unquote influencers on YouTube and TikTok. And the venues for this has kind of moved away from cable television and moved onto these social media platforms. So it will be interesting to see what they do on Hulu and see if they manage to find a way to sort of create another iteration of this kind of fame and this kind of revenue.
Well, that brings me to this new documentary on FX and Hulu. It's called The New York Times Presents, Who Gets to Be an Influencer? It's about a group of black content creators on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. So let's take a listen to that.
If you're going to make it on the internet, you need to strike fast. One of the best ways is to join with other people who want to do the same thing, to collaborate. But the challenge is making it in an industry that's not made for us.
What about this show, Eric, and the quest here for social media stardom?
Yeah, this is a really interesting look at a disturbing phenomenon, which is that black content creators who try to become social media influencers have a much harder time amassing large number of followers. They have a harder time getting endorsements. They just have a harder time making a career in this space. And there's even some suspicion that the algorithms of some of the social media platforms that they use may be attuned so that their posts don't do as well because their skin tone is darker. So there's a lot of interesting stuff sort of explored in this documentary, and I hope people check it out.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, Eric, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.